From the Sky News Centre at 6, one man has died and two others are injured after a shooting at a hotel in Dublin where a boxing tournament weigh-in was taking place. Unconfirmed reports say assault rifles may have been used. Local reporter Helen Vaughan says there are also claims the attackers were dressed in police-style uniforms.
I've talked to some of the guys who were at this boxing event and they said that they were all just standing around, some getting weighed in, some just eating, and that a bunch of men burst into the foyer of the hotel, opened fire. They believe they were holding AK-47s.
Julian Assange says a UN report that's found his being detained arbitrarily in the UK is a victory for him. Barry Weir reports.
Julian Assange addressing supporters from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy earlier. He's still there, despite this UN panel saying he should be allowed to walk free.
How sweet it is. This is a victory that cannot be denied.
The WikiLeaks founder's been living inside the embassy in London for over 3 years to avoid being sent to Sweden to face questioning over rape allegations, which he denies. The Foreign Secretary rejects the UN findings.
Julian Assange is a fugitive from justice.
Mr. Assange now wants the UN to put pressure on the British and Swedish authorities.
Police have arrested a man wanted over the murder of a mum of four in Kent. Caroline Andrews' body was found at a house in Benenden yesterday. Officers say they found the 54-year-old man in the London area this afternoon. A man's been found guilty of murdering a 14-year-old boy who he saw as a love rival in a cemetery in Cumbria. Prosecutors said 19-year-old George Thompson had an obsessive desire for Jordan Watson's girlfriend. The jury is still to reach verdicts on two others who deny murder. A 38-year-old man has been killed and three others injured after a giant construction crane collapsed in Manhattan. The victim was sitting in a parked car in the Tribeca neighbourhood. And Sir Terry Wogan's funeral will take place next week. A statement's been issued saying it will be a private service for the family and no further details will be released. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
A corporation is not a person. It doesn't think. People in it think. And for them, it is legitimate to create Terminator technology so that farmers are not able to save their seeds. Seeds that will destroy themselves through a suicide gene. Seeds that are designed to only produce crop in one season. You really need to have a brutal mind. It's a war against evolution to even think in those terms.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The supposed discovery of Roman artefacts around Newfoundland over Christmas has reawakened questions over Bristol's own role in the discovery, supposed, of America. Did the Romans and the Vikings get there first? Did English fishermen know all about the nearby Grand Banks as a fishing ground but kept it quiet? Were there European encampments even in Virginia and elsewhere before the Matthew and John Cabot began the process of mapping the coastline in 1497? Also, US intelligence officers kidnapping Muslims in Italy, then fleeing to Portugal, but the Italian justice system this week is catching up with them. And the Pentagon quadrupled their European defence spending on the same week as the BBC transmit a war game programme about Russian tanks invading the Baltic states. Is this what they call predictive programming? So, an innocent bit of fun on the television, or psychological warfare against politicians and the public? But it's hardly news, but we start this week with John Cabot, and I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Evan Jones from Bristol University's Cabot Project. Hi, Evan, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Now, when I saw this thing about the Romans over Christmas, I was immediately sceptical. I didn't really think the Romans would manage to get that far. Could you tell us if you've had a look at this and what you make of the so-called discovery?
Well, there are, I mean, basically someone has found, I think it's just south of Newfoundland, or they say they've found a Roman sword and some Roman coins, and this is their claim that maybe the Romans sort of visited there in the 2nd century BC, sorry, AD. I mean, I have talked to some people about this, and there is quite a lot of scepticism about these finds. I mean, they haven't been found by archaeologists in stratified contexts. So even if they are genuine, and it's not that difficult to buy sort of Roman artifacts on the internet, including things like swords and coins, there's actually no way of knowing right now whether or not they were actually, you know, genuinely found there, or whether or not they might have been put there by somebody.
But he's got a great name, the lead historian, Jovan Hutton Pulitzer. Maybe his family's got something to do with the Pulitzer Prize, who knows? But anyway, he sounds very grand, but he believes the hall is firm evidence that the great empire landed there first, and it's the single most important discovery ever in the Americas. Well, I suppose all historians like to think that, don't they?
Yeah, they do sometimes, and yes, I've read this story. But I mean, the difficulty is that sort of no archaeologist has actually found it and said, yes, these artifacts were found in sealed deposit, which we can actually date by other means as being that. In fact, I mean, basically someone just turned up and said, oh, look, I found this Roman sword and these Roman coins. They haven't actually been tested yet to see if they are Roman. But as I say, even if they were Roman, that doesn't necessarily prove that they were put there, dropped there by the Romans. So, I mean, at the moment, I think, you know, you're right to be sceptical.
OK, now, John Cabot is the sort of main person we underline as the discoverer from Europe of America, at least the first person to map it properly, although, of course, you know, this is likely that there were other voyages across the North Atlantic before him. So what do you know about those?
Well, we know that Bristol was involved in a series of voyages from the 1470s looking for lands out in the Atlantic. There's some people who believe that they might have found something, but there's really, to be honest, no evidence of this before 1497.
I mean, aren't we sort of hamstrung here by a quite stark financial economic fact that if they did find something, if they did find lands, that they were very reluctant to share that knowledge with others because actually that this could be a nice little earner?
Well, people say this, but then the thing is the logic would be they were going after fishery, and actually Bristol's never been a great fishing port, and even after they discovered it in 1497 they didn't try to exploit a fishery there, which kind of makes it a bit difficult. And also this notion that somehow you'd be able to keep a large-scale fishery secret over a period of decades is, to be honest, nonsense. Bristol wasn't a closed port. We were trading at this time all the time with Portugal, with Spain. You know, we knew what they were doing and they knew what we were doing.
So was there complete information sharing? I mean, this is one of the things that we do know about in aviation, don't we? Aviation safety is a very good subject, I think, anyway, because every time there's any kind of an accident or a near miss, that kind of thing, information is shared freely and widely. But surely that is not going to be the situation. If someone comes across a new bit of territory, or, should we say, maybe fishing banks like the Grand Banks, if they start telling everyone else about it, then they're going to be able to share that profit, that knowledge.
Well,
let me give you
the best example of information sharing in this period. John Cabot sails in 1497, comes back in August. By December, a series of letters have been written to him by Bristol merchants describing to Christopher Columbus, his arch rival, describing exactly where Cabot had been, exactly what he had done, you know, where he'd gone, what he'd visited, how long they'd landed, how many people he had on his ship. All this information got through to Columbus by January 1498, just 3 or 4 months later. That's how good the information networks were, and we know that because we actually have at least one of the most important sources for Cabot voyages is this letter, which gets written by a Bristol merchant called John Day to Christopher Columbus, telling him everything he needed to know.
So they were actually quite good at sharing this knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, Bristol merchants, Bristol ships, people going backwards and forwards all the time between sort of Lisbon, Portugal, Spain. You know, each ship, I mean, any ship, a Bristol ship wouldn't have a small number, you know, it'd have a number of mariners on it. They go backwards and forwards. Mariners, seamen talk in pubs, merchants. They have lots of business associates all over the place. There's business people from Portugal working in Bristol. You know, you don't get to keep this sort of information quiet for very long.
Okay, what about these earlier voyages? Okay, we can probably say unlikely the Romans made it, but what about the people like the Vikings?
Oh, well, the Vikings definitely got there around about 1000. We know that not just because there are written records of the voyages of Leif Erikson around 1000, but there's actually the archaeological remains of a Viking encampment, which is in northern Newfoundland. I mean, you know, and you can visit this site. It's been excavated. It's, you know, the archaeological culture, the remains left by the Vikings are totally different from the sort of Native Americans living there. So we know absolutely for certain that they were there, and actually that people were visiting from Greenland over the next couple of centuries. But then that sort of contact died out when the Greenland colony died out in about the 14th century. And so when people talk about John Cabot, it's really about the rediscovery of North America in 1497 by these Bristol explorers.
What about rumours of other kinds of cultures in North America, not just Native American culture? I believe it's in Virginia, one of the Virginias, rumours anyway, of some kind of European encampment there, which was there before Europeans like Columbus and Cabot discovered America.
Yeah. I mean, the difficulty is that there's, with all these things, I mean, there's a lot of people have a lot of stories because there's this huge competition, to be honest, among sort of people thinking, we want to be there first. We want to have got there before Christopher Columbus. And, you know, so you get stories about Basques, French, you know, almost anyone basically has got a story about like how we got there first. And, you know, I'd absolutely love it, you know, to think that Bristol men had managed to get there first and they had actually been exploring along the coastline well beforehand. Unfortunately, as historians, you know, you actually need hard evidence. You need to be able, like a journalist, you need to be able to go back and trace things back to the manuscript. And too often these stories get overlaid with sort of myths and legends and people saying, oh, X happened or Y happened. And when you actually look into them, there's actually no real firm evidential basis for it.
Okay, but you do have to do a bit of speculation, don't you? And then check out with facts afterwards. Are there any other things you point to about communications that were going on between Europe and America before Cabot and Columbus?
Well, you know, Columbus, obviously, there 1492. Really, there is, I mean, there's possible evidence that Portuguese might have reached, it's tentative evidence, South America before Columbus in 1492, or at least around about that time. So, you know, later on, obviously, the Portuguese then went and sort of took hold of Brazil, and so they settled that. So there's some evidence there, but there's really no evidence of sort of Bristol mariners or English mariners actually having visited before 1497. I think there's lots of stories about it, largely because people want to believe it. And, you know, when people really want to believe something, then, you know, it's kind of quite hard to dissuade
them.
There's
a sort of circumstantial thing, isn't there, Evan, between the Egyptian pyramids and the South American Indian pyramids. They look sort of almost as if they were being designed by people with a similar culture. I wonder maybe, you know, if the ancient Egyptians had some, if there's any evidence.
You could say there's quite a lot of similarities between the sort of adobe huts built by Native Americans and very similar mud brick huts built in sort of Mesopotamia or in the Near East. I mean, a lot of it is just about sort of the technologies they had available. There's, you know, there's, doesn't necessarily mean they're actually linked. I mean, probably the strongest reason for thinking they weren't is that if you look at the impact after Columbus, in terms of the introduction of things like old world pathogens to the new world, and the devastating impact that had, you know, reduced the population of the new world by 95% over the next century, that wouldn't have happened if there had been extensive contact between the old world and the new world before that. It was really these new diseases, new animals, the sort of crops and so on which were brought back in return. All that happened after 1492, and, you know, that kind of rather suggests there wasn't a lot of contact before then.
A lot of people have suggested that some of that was deliberate, that diseases were spread deliberately. Is there evidence for that?
People didn't know enough about diseases. Much later on, there's some evidence of, for instance, in the sort of 17th century, of sort of blankets and so on, which had been possibly infected by smallpox being given. But certainly in those early centuries, people just didn't know enough about disease. They didn't know how it was really spread. So, the things which were killing the Native Americans in huge numbers, such as, you know, a lot of them were diseases which were quite common here, such as sort of measles, influenza, then also things like plague and smallpox, which had been killing people in Europe and in Asia and Africa for centuries. And it was, you know, these introduction of these diseases to people who had no natural immunity, which caused sort of massive devastation, combined, it has to be said, with a very cruel treatment of those native peoples and the enslavement of them as well by the sort of conquistadors and people like that.
Well, I mean, I've been to the Pequot Museum in New England, the Pequot Indians, and the film they show there is pretty frightening. In fact, one of the things that some of the Indians are doing when they first sight the first ships that are coming in the late 1400s, early 15th, late 15th century. They're seeing, some are saying, well, this is a harbinger of doom, you know, and others are saying, well, actually, no, they're just people like you and I. It must have been pretty horrific for people in succeeding years to see the way they were going to be treated. Effectively, something like, I mean, figures vary for just North America and North America and South America, but it really was quite a devastating genocide that took place over the succeeding hundreds of years.
Absolutely, I agree with you entirely. I mean, it was both the way in which, you know, these people the people were treated, but also, you know, I mean, you know, huge numbers of people were sort of massacred, I mean, especially for sort of the Spanish and so on, largely because the English didn't actually follow through after 1497 greatly until the late 16th century. But, vast numbers of people died, I mean, particularly the diseases which are spread through. I mean, diseases which have been killing people in Europe. I mean, remember things like plague outbreaks had been killing up to a third, up to a half of the population of Europe in fairly regular outbreaks since the 1348. And when these diseases then came to the Americas, came to people who had no resistance to them at all, yeah, they caused devastation there.
Is there anything about Cabot's voyage and the man himself that you've discovered over the last few years that you think has added to our understanding of, you know, who was behind those voyages and what it all meant for history and the creation of America? Because a lot of people point to America today and say, well, actually, what we did is we created a monster.
Yeah, I suppose, well, maybe not for the American, but it's in terms of, I mean,
even some Americans would say that.
I think one of the most interesting things we've been finding out sort of researching this project is that, we'd always thought of Cabot's voyages as being purely a Bristol venture. I mean, we know that John Cabot was actually a Venetian. Juan Caboto is his proper name, who came from Venice in northern Italy. But, you know, he'd always thought of these as being basically an English venture. I mean, one of the things we found is that he was partly financed actually by an Italian bank based in London. I mean, the Italians were the great bankers of that time. And, this was an Italian bank called the Bardi, who were based in Florence. And they were helping to finance his voyages, while at the same time, they were also helping to finance voyages from Spain by sort of Christopher Columbus and others. So, you know, from their point of view, I kind of think these bankers, I mean, I heard just sort of slight disparaging comments about bankers earlier, but from their point of view, I think you might sort of say it shows that you can never trust bankers because they'll always just be going after the bottom line. You know, they were doing things which the Spanish were very unhappy about, but they were just backing anyone they thought they could make money out of.
It was, I think, also maybe telling that it wasn't a captain that they chose to make the voyage. It was a foreigner. Was it? Did Cabot have particular skills?
I think, I mean, he had knowledge, certainly. He'd been trading in the Mediterranean. He claims he visited Mecca, which is probably unlikely, but he would certainly been trading with the sort of Ottoman Empire before he came to Bristol. So he had knowledge of the routes east, and at the end of the day, we've got to remember, he wasn't looking for America. He was hoping to sail across the Atlantic, hoping to find a route to Asia from which he'd be able to start trade with. So that's what he was after. He had that knowledge. He's somebody who comes across, to be honest, as somebody who's got, as much as anything, the sort of the gift of the gap. He's a very good salesman. Before he came to Bristol, he'd actually been trying to sell himself as a civil engineer in Spain, building a bridge over at Seville, for instance, over a river. Wasn't successful, got made unemployed. And then comes to these Bristol merchants and says, I can find a route for you. I mean, I know you've been searching for a route across the Atlantic. You've been looking for lands across the Atlantic for the last couple of decades, but I can help you do this. You know, I have the knowledge.
I'm your guy.
Yeah.
Also, the sort of world he was in at the time was very much governed, or certainly in the background, one of the things we don't necessarily think much about, by not the Bristol's merchant venturers who came afterwards. They were only got their charter in 1552, I think.
It was the same guys, to be honest. I mean, it's the same group of people who, or the same merchant class, which, to be honest, ruled Bristol pretty much from about the 11th century up until kind of really the 19th century or so. I mean, this city is...
The sons of the previous generations?
Well, either sons or
families?
Or sometimes the same families, sometimes people who've been apprenticed in. I mean, it's a fairly fluid in that sense. But yes, sometimes you get sort of multiple generations of merchants, but it's the same kind of oligarchy class. I mean, they're the people who also rule the city. They're the ones who are most of the mayors and the sheriffs and MPs of the city. And I mean, you've got to remember, really, until the 19th century, Bristol's economy was almost entirely based on overseas trade. I mean, that's what made this city tick. That's why Cabot came here. You've got to remember, in the 15th century, it was the second most important city, really, in England. It was a rich city from the Middle Ages onwards.
And the slave trade certainly didn't disparage from that. In fact, it expanded massively because of the slave trade. But let's just go back to the 1200s and the 1300s and the Hanseatic League and the merchant adventurers. Not the merchant venturers, the merchant adventurers were a kind of... people would point to them at the day, I would imagine, as saying, actually, you guys are a bunch of monopolists. You're just trying to control all the trade and stop other people getting in. Who were the Hanseatic League and these people?
Well, I mean, these are sort of different groups. So the Hanseatic League were kind of a group of North German towns, places like what's Gdansk, well, what's now Gdansk was then Danzig, Hamburg, Lübeck, all these sort of cities around the Baltic, which were formed a great sort of merchant trading network. And yeah, they were trading, but they were trading mostly with London and across the North Sea. They didn't have much trade with Bristol. And then you get the Italians of a kind of a really great international traders of this period and bankers in the sort of 15th century. But I mean, what
were
was
they mostly Venetian, but Venice, basically?
Venice, or Genoa, yeah. Florence, mostly those three sort of great city states. But they were the sort of the chief bankers. But Bristol was different. I mean, it may be interesting that actually most English, I mean, people often think of Britain as being a sort of naturally somehow geared to the sea, but it wasn't involved much in overseas trade at this time. And Bristol was actually distinctive in the sense that Bristol had this large trade, and it was mostly controlled by local men using local ships rather than using things like foreign ships and leaving it to the actual foreign merchants to actually do the trade. So that's one of the reasons why Cabot came to Bristol, that Bristol had a long-standing interest in a heavily developed overseas trade, trading as far as Iceland to the north and as far down as the Straits of Gibraltar to the south. So they had this very big, extensive trade network already, and that's why they were interested in trying to expand their trade and look for new lands. And that's why Cabot came here.
We know about Victorian-era shipbuilding, but did Bristol build these sorts of ships in medieval times as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and they had some of the greatest ships in the realm. I mean, during this period, you get ships of several hundred tons, 500, 600, 700 tons, which is actually very big compared to the standard of most shipping at that time. It wasn't quite as big as the great Genoese carracks, which sailed between the Eastern Mediterranean and Northern Europe. But they were very great ships by that time, yes.
I remember reading, this is a while ago, but I think I'm right in saying that the finest sailing ships were the clippers, and they could actually go faster than the powered ships, coal ships, and the people still like using the clippers because they didn't have to fill half the holdup with coal to power the steamships. So there was still quite a use for sail right up until Victorian times. But the merchant adventurers, I think we need to just sort of separate them from our own Bristol merchant venturers. They were closed down. I'm not sure what the date was. Is it they lost their charter in 1689 because they were accused of being too monopolistic.
Are you talking about the merchant adventurers of London?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think they were from Holland and Belgium and London. They had various bases.
The merchant adventurers of London, they secured in the sort of end of the 15th century the monopoly on the export of English woolen cloth, which was the main export England produced at this time, to the Netherlands, basically. And that was a very major trade, and by the end of the 16th century, most of actual English trade consisted of the merchant adventurers exporting woolen cloth. This is about 90% of English exports to the Netherlands. So places like Bristol, has to be said, were kind of fairly peripheral to that. And yes, they lost a lot. I mean, I think, to be honest, all groups of merchants tended to be, you know, I mean, Adam Smith, you know, says that, you know, but, you know, you get two or three merchants or businessmen together and they will try to combine to defraud the consumer.
Yeah, I think the conversation usually ends in a conspiracy against the public.
Yeah.
I think it's something like isn't it? Martin, let me bring you in here because we're talking here about trade deals. We're talking about organisations like the Hanseatic League, the Merchant Venturers, the Merchant Adventurers that were associations of merchants. But actually, we haven't gone that far from that. We're now talking about a massive trade deal called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership as well. Bigger deals with bigger organisations of merchants around the world deciding what they want to do.
Well, there's clearly a historical continuity between this kind of globalised capitalism. I mean, it was, you know, we're talking about people doing stuff for money, aren't we? That's and that's the continuity. Although I did understand that it was the Crown, Henry VII, wasn't it, that pushed this expedition. So, and you were saying that that in both Spain and in the Bardi were funding all of this, but I think they wanted the public sector, if you like, the Crown involved, because, you know, it's risky and the Crown's taking some of the risk. And
the Crown, the Crown doesn't provide finance. In fact, the only time, well, they don't provide finance, Henry VII doesn't provide finance. What he actually provides is political guarantees by offering, by giving them letters patent, which is a grant to carry out these voyages. It means two things. It means, first of all, if he discovers new lands, then other people can't sail there. So this is trying to protect the investment. And what he doesn't want to do is sail there, discover a new route to Asia, and come back and say, I've discovered a new route to Asia. And then everyone else says, that's great. You've spent all this money doing it, but now we can just muscle in and trade. So it's providing a monopoly versus other potential merchants in England. But it's also meaning that he's getting to sail under the king's flag, under the king's flag, which means that anyone who attacks his ship, and if the Spanish or Portuguese could potentially have done this, if they attacked his ship, they'd be attacking the king, and that would promote a diplomatic incident. So what the king is doing is providing political guarantees, which aren't unimportant.
No, well, I mean, I think that, you know, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership and so on, the geopolitics of free markets. I mean, if you're a free market economist, then you don't need trade deals. Everybody just deals with everybody else on an open basis. And having trade deals implies that you've actually got a closed system and you're negotiating about how it's going to be managed rather than having a free market
system.
Hang on
a minute, because what you're doing with a trade deal is you're saying, well, actually, we're not going to be putting excises on products as they're coming out, in and out of the country, sure.
Yeah, but I mean, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership and the Asian Investment Partnership is basically designed to contain Russia and China. They are geopolitical goals. We've got sanctions on Russia at the moment. Goodness knows why, because we're the main aggressors in the Ukraine and in Syria. But we've got sanctions on them, and we're perhaps going to come to discuss, you know, this BBC war game programme later in the show.
Afterwards,
but I mean, the fact is that just from a logical point of view, having a trade and investment partnership which actually locks in the European Union to the US, which is what it's all about, basically, is designed to lock the Russians out. And there's no free market here at all. What we're talking about is manoeuvring to control monopoly, effectively.
Sounds like,
and that was the same in the medieval era. There was no free market then either.
Getting even tighter though than it was in medieval times. And if essentially what the merchants are trying to do here is to shut out the competition more and more nowadays. But anyway, I know you've been looking into this woman Alwyn Ruddock and some of her work on John Cabot. So how did you first come across her work, and why is it important, do you think?
Well, she was a historian based at the University of London for sort of 30 or 40 years, from the 1950s to mid-1970s. And she carried out, during the early 1960s, she discovered a set of documents while working in Italy to do with John Cabot and the discovery voyages, which were really important because we know very little about these voyages. I mean, some of the documents, she discovered new letters, she discovered actually the accounts to do the Bardi, which I mentioned. And then for about 30 or 40 years, she kept saying she was going to publish her findings, but she never let go. She couldn't just let go and publish. Instead, she was always looking for the next bit of evidence. And when she got finally aged 89 in 2005 when she died, she left these very peculiar instructions which she wanted all her research notes burnt and destroyed, because I think she was paranoid that other people were going to find this stuff and then pretend it was their own. So she spent 40 years, to be honest, acting as dog in the manger in this area. I mean, she was an extremely good scholar. She clearly had found a lot of information. She stopped anyone else from doing any research in it because no one else wanted to go in and do something and then find out, you know, that she had been preempted by her publications. And then she dies in 2005, and it all kind of gets destroyed. And that's kind of where I got involved, because as an academic, as a historian who works on this area, you know, this kind of rather upset me, I might say. And, you know, what I wanted to do was actually see if she could actually find out initially what it was she'd found, because she'd always been very cagey about it. And then later on, once we actually worked that out, find out if we could actually relocate any of the documents she found, with, I should say, due acknowledgement to her having found many of these things.
So how did you get on?
Well, we found quite a few of the documents, partly through context relating to her, and partly simply by looking at the sort of places we think she would have looked at. I mean, we found, you know, we found, for instance, evidence of a new voyage we'd never known about, which took place in 1499 from Bristol, led by a Bristol merchant called William Weston. I mean, this was actually the first English-led expedition to North America, and nobody had even realised it had happened. No one ever heard of this Bristol merchant, William Weston. So that's kind of one of the things we found. I mean, there's various other things which are very interested in finding, I mean, including her claims that she thinks that a group of friars who sailed with Cabot in 1499 on his last voyage actually established a colony in Newfoundland, a religious colony in Newfoundland, and that would be the first you know, Christian colony in North America, which obviously people in Canada and so on are very excited about. So
but
we're looking for that.
No archaeological evidence for that yet, though?
No. We know where she thought it was, a place called Carbonier in Newfoundland. And so we know where it was, and there has been some archaeological, but the actual whole area has actually been built over quite heavily now. And if it was, I mean, she wasn't suggesting it was more than possibly a year or two that this actual colony survived.
Occurs to me we ought to mention Prester John at this point, who's the guy that kept everybody guessing for centuries. In fact, because I think maybe you could explain this a little bit better than me, Evan, but I think he was basically a fake letter put out by the Vatican that said that that there was this Christian king who ruled the three Indies that was fighting the Muslims from the other side, and that we all had to fight the Muslims to help this fictitious king, Prester John. But it actually kept many explorers gripped for centuries, and kings, and, you know, in fact, the whole continent was trying to help this guy that never existed at all.
Well, I think a lot of people think that the actual stories of Prester John, and it wasn't just about the Vatican, were actually based in you know, true information about the Christian Copts of Ethiopia, who are on the kind of other side of the Ottoman Empire, and that, you know, these, you know, obviously,
so there was an element of truth.
There were Christians. I mean, they weren't, you know, people very much regard themselves as Christians today. I mean, but they were a very separate religious tradition from the Roman Catholic tradition. So there were Christians, kind of on the other side of the Islamic Empire. He wasn't as rich or powerful as they thought these people were going to be. There wasn't a single individual called Prester John. Obviously, you know, would only be who, you know, no one lives for hundreds of years anyway. But yeah, there was a belief that you know, many of the early explorers, backed by Henry the Navigator, the Portuguese king, were hoping to sort of get beyond the Sahara Desert, and that one of the things they thought they'd be able to do by doing this would be to sort of link up with the Prester John and fight the Ottoman Empire and the sort of Kingdom of Morocco and these places, which are seen very much as the enemy at the time.
Well, we can smile now, but this actually did, you know, a lot of policy on a national level was based around this being fact. It's amazing that people can get things so wrong for so long.
Well, they had other reasons for going as well. I mean, you know, the chief reason for sailing down the coast of Africa was they wanted to get the gold, which is coming out of sub-Saharan Africa, and which the Moroccan the Kingdom of Morocco were taking on caravans across the Sahara Desert.
So Prester John was a convenient excuse, maybe.
He was one of the reasons, but probably not the main reason. And certainly, actually, once they got down to the Gold Coast and started bringing back gold and other goods, ivory and so on, you know, they were more interested in the bottom line, I think, than they were in than anything else.
Evan, where's a good place for people to go to read about this or to catch up, and maybe good documentaries online, or to get up to date with the Bristol's role in the Cabot voyage?
It's. I mean, there's one of the difficulties.
They could probably come and do a course up at the university.
Yeah, they can sort of come and sort of do a course. There's various things we have on the website, which we've sort of published, and which is freely available articles. I mean, one of the things I've done is we partly try not to be like Alwyn Ruddock, because I mean, she's such a peculiar woman, that I've made sure that every time we've published anything, it's been made publicly available. And so there's lots of stuff about our research which you can find out about, which will also provide background to the voyages, which is freely available online. So if you sort of Google the Cabot Project, just Google Cabot Project, you'll find those links.
Is there much left in Bristol, records from these times? I mean, they've got an almost public archive, haven't they?
The Bristol Record Office.
Yeah,
there's not a huge amount from the 15th century, and very little which relates to Cabot. I mean, one of the funny things about Cabot is that, you know, we think of him as being famous today, but at the time he was just another merchant, you know, and people weren't that interested. So, for instance, when you look at Bristol's Town Chronicle, which is written during this period, you know, you look at the entries for the 1490s, and they're full of things like, the king visiting Bristol, and the repaving of Broad Street, and mending the city quays and so on. And this is what the town clerk is writing about the really important things happening in Bristol. What he doesn't write about at all at any point is the Bristol Discovery Voyages, or really anything else to do with merchants, because I think they just regard it as merchants' business. They don't regard it as being that important to the time. And it only seems to be important to them, you know, a century or more later, after, you know, you get efforts to sort of start colonising North America by the French and the English.
Any good books?
Any good books to read? Nothing really kind of recent. I mean, I'm actually working on a sort of more sort of popular history booklet, which should probably be sold through at least the Matthew of Bristol at the moment, because partly I want to try to sort of communicate this stuff to a broader audience. So that will hopefully be coming out in the sort of next couple of months, but I don't want to be sounding as if I came on here to plug this.
Okay. I suppose we should finish where we started, really, which was Martin's comment a few weeks ago about the Grand Banks. Martin, do you just want to remind us what you were saying
verify? This is all fascinating. I'm just aware that I read, and you may be aware of this, that the idea that the Bristol merchants had discovered the Grand Banks, but as you said, they weren't really fishermen. And, of course, the idea that in this book, I can't remember who wrote it, the idea that America was possibly named after a Bristol Welsh merchant, Ap Merrick.
Yeah, Richard Ap Merrick.
Rather than Amerigo Vespucci.
Who you would love, actually, by the way. He's a fantastically corrupt guy, originally from Chepstow, and he's massively on the make. I mean, we've been pursuing this guy. We found out loads and loads of evidence of him being involved in various fraudulent activities in the 1490s, getting trouble with the king,
This is Ap Merrick?
Yeah, this is Ap Merrick. But but to be honest, there's absolutely zero evidence that he was actually financing or supporting John
Cabot. I thought
you
were talking about the author of the book.
No.
I mean, I realise that it's not academic history.
No, I'm not.
It's an interesting idea, but I mean, I bow to your superior knowledge.
Well, it's based on the fact...
You know more about it than I do.
It goes back to the late 19th century, and it's based on the fact that people write names. I mean, one of the silliest things you'll ever hear about, say, Shakespeare, is like, oh, he can't possibly have written all these plays because he spells his name in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, everyone did that all the time. You would do that, you know, if you were to, you know, you just think, oh, actually, I feel like spelling my name this way today. Mm. And people like Richard, you know, he's a Welshman, really, Richard Ap Merrick from Chepstow. But he writes his name, or people write his name in lots of different ways. I mean, sometimes it's Richard Americk, sometimes it's Richard Merrick.
Quite a lot of crooks do that, don't
well,
they?
Yeah, but in this period, everyone does it. I mean, John Cabot, as I say, is an example. I mean, when he was in Venice, he's Juan Caboto. He goes to Florence, he's Giovanni Caboto. He goes to Spain, he's Juan Caboto. He comes to England, he's John Cabot. That's not because he was, well, he might have been a crook, but that's not the reason he was doing it. It's just that that's what everyone did in that period. They weren't as kind of, you know, worked up. I mean, sometimes I get my students saying, I'm not Sophia, I'm Sophia. And, you know, people get very worked up about their name forms, but in this period, they just didn't. No. And anyway, so one version of Richard Ap Merrick's name is written Richard Americk. And in the late 19th century, someone said, that looks rather like America. Perhaps this guy, actually Cabot, comes back and he names it after him. You know, unfortunately, there's no evidence for it. I mean, he's a Bristol's customs officer. He's the man who pays Cabot his pension, his annual salary from the king. But really, the only connection, he's basically the tax man. He's the king is paying out of revenues collected in the port of Bristol, because that's where the king has a pot of money and he wants to pay Cabot his pension. So that's the only known connection we have.
Okay, so is it Vespucci? Because I've heard rumours that he changed his name as well. It wasn't his original name or something.
Well, yeah, I'm going to go... Vespucci is, I mean, there's very, very strong case. He's actually another Italian, actually, but okay. It's a he sails, and the a map written in 1507 actually names the continent of America after him, and it's actually there's a legend on the map. There's a some writing on the map where he says he has a picture of Vespucci and says I'm naming it after him. But actually, at that time, it was only applied to South America. The name America doesn't start getting applied to North America until about 50 or 60 years later. So it would be kind of a very odd thing for this land, which, you know, at the end of the day was around Newfoundland, which the Bristol people had been exploring, to actually somehow that name to transfer itself down. Mm. Quite apart from the fact, by 1507, the map maker is very clear about who he's naming it for.
They've realised that the two are joined in Central America. They're, of course,
they don't realise that at that stage. They don't actually. No. I mean, Columbus. Even one of the things about Columbus, I mean, Columbus is such an idiot, but he goes there thinking it's the Indies. By the time of his death in 1506, 14 years later, he still thinks it's the Indies. I mean, everyone else by that time has worked out there's these big continents of the way, but he thinks that this is Asia, because he was so set on discovering Asia that he's convinced it has to be. But at that time, you know, up until really. I mean, apart from possibly the Bristol Discovery voyages, which I think probably did explore down quite a lot of the coast of America this time, there's no record actually of the Spanish reaching any part of North America until about 1513.
We don't see much of the Matthew in the floating harbour these days. It seems to be off most of the time.
It's around quite a bit. It was undergoing it every year. It has to be taken out of water down on the underfold yard, and it was out of there for a few weeks, I think, while they were doing its annual maintenance check, but I think it's back in the water again now.
Anyway, it's been a great pleasure, Evan Jones. Evan Jones, sorry. Thanks very much for joining us, and people can find your... I'll put a link on our show page to your Cabot Project pages up at the university. Thanks very much for joining us today on the pod. It felt a little bit like Melvin Bragg in our time today. Not quite so bang up to date with news, but certainly fascinating for me anyway. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now let the music play.
Our second subject on the politics show today, and that is this programme that's been going out, or was going out on the BBC this week, about a Russian invasion of the Baltic states. Martin, I'm not sure if you saw it, did you?
I saw it was on, but I just couldn't bear to watch it, so I just didn't watch it.
There was quite a lot of participants in it were NATO people, generals, I imagine, but there were also a few people sort of from the political world involved in it, who were saying, well, this is a little bit propagandistic, one or two of them. What are your thoughts about the purpose of programmes like that, and who's really behind them?
Well, it's blatantly propagandistic. There is no evidence to suggest that the Russians have any intention of invading the Baltic states.
Well, NATO will say, hang on a minute, because the Russians have got a load of tanks just to the east of the border.
Well, the Russians have got a load of tanks on their territory by the border. If you've got a military and you are Russia, where are you going to deploy your tanks? You're going to deploy them on the border in case somebody attacks you. And, of course, they have been attacked in Ukraine. There's been an attempt to draw them into a conflict. There's a brilliant French documentary that's just come out on Canal Plus about the whole Maidan coup, which points the finger firmly at the Western intelligence services for shooting the protesters in the Maidan Square and the police officers, and also points the finger at the far-right paramilitaries for killing all the people in the Odessa Trade Union Hall some weeks later. In other words, the whole thing has been orchestrated by NATO intelligence services in order to start a fight with the Russians. They're the aggressors. They're the British, as Roland Dumas Sigmar, the former French foreign minister, said they approached him and said, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. So we have been going out of our way to pick a fight with the Russians, which the Russians have rather wisely avoided getting into.
The thing that bothered me about this was we had a kind of a programme called London Under Attack from the BBC just a few months before the 7/7 London mm-hmm. bombings, which actually featured Peter Power, who was one of the people a lot of people had pointed the finger at as being somehow involved because of his exercise that he was running the same day at the same three tube stations where the bombs were going off on the 7/7 London bombings. So what is this? What's the purpose of having a programme that then you have a real event in the real world after it?
Well, they're basically trying to demonise the Putin regime and the Russian political setup. That's what's going on. It's blatantly propagandistic. And, of course, the Russian foreign ministry has complained about this and saying, look, you know, you can make up any scenario you like. And, of course, it's all about the idea that we've got to increase defence spending because the Russians are on the march, the Russians are coming, they've got to be stopped, they've seized Crimea, they've seized Ukraine, they're fighting in Syria, what are we going to do? Well, what we do is we arm and train the jihadis in Syria. That's exactly what we've been doing. NATO, and particularly the Turks, but also the Saudis, have been arming and training ISIS and to fight against the secular regime, which is a democratically elected regime in Damascus, far more better democratically elected, for example, than the regime in Egypt, military regime in Egypt, or the regime in Saudi Arabia where elections don't happen at all.
There's something creepy about this because when the event itself happens, then there's always something in the back of your mind that says, well, hang on, I kind of knew that was going to happen, and that's because you've seen it on TV first.
That's right. They are basically trying to get the population into a mindset where when they say that we are going to go to war with Russia, they will say, oh, yes, that terrible Putin, something's happened. I saw a BBC programme about that, blah, blah, blah. It's very dangerous, frankly, to do that. It's provocative. It's fortunately the Russians are very calm in the way they're dealing with these provocations, and they basically just laugh when these suggestions are made. The Russians have no interest whatsoever in retaking the Baltic states. There is a danger, though, because you've got a large Russian minority population, particularly in Latvia, which is nearly half the population, and in Estonia, where it's about a third of the population, much lower in Lithuania, about 8%. But there could be a Northern Ireland-style fight between the Russian population in Latvia, for example, and the Latvian regime, because the Latvian regime has done everything it can to disenfranchise the Russian population and basically to make them go away. They haven't, because, you know, they don't want to. But the potential for a conflict within those countries is there. But that depends upon the politics of the countries concerned. It's nothing to do with the Russians.
One of the reasons for this, the BBC, a lot of people pointing the finger, questioning the BBC particularly, is that the chairman of the BBC for the last year or so, 18 months actually now, I think it is this lady Rona Fairhead, who has quite an amazing set of jobs that she's had over the years, but her main one being on the risk committee of HSBC, who we were talking about earlier on, Martin.
Yeah, she's also something to do with BAE Systems, is she not? I mean, the purpose of all this warmongering is to sell weaponry. I don't actually think they want to fight with the Russians, because if they did, they'd get beaten. They're stupid. All the war games they've actually fought, where they fight the Russians within a 1,000 miles of the Russian border, the Russians thrash them, as you might expect.
Okay, let's just take a little look at Rona Fairhead. St Catherine's College, Cambridge, president of the university's Law Society. Then she went off to Harvard Business School. Then she joined something called Bain & Company. I'm not sure if you can say anything about who they are, Martin.
No idea.
Morgan Stanley.
Well, we know who they are. They're major league bankers stroke hedge fund
investment
thieves.
Banker guys. Then British Aerospace, Bombardier, Short Brothers, UK Aerospace, ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, also the Financial Times Group, And then a non-executive director, HSB C Holdings. Her husband is director of Campbell Lutyens, a massive energy fund. And last week she spoke to Andrew Marr on the Andrew Marr Show, who did actually put, I think, one question, which was a little bit about her business background and her extremely dodgy connections with the big banksters, money launderers, etc. at HSBC.
She is clearly a corporate shill. Let's put too fine a point on it. As we were mentioning in the first hour, HSBC were convicted in the courts in the US of money laundering for the Sinaloa cartel, the ones who were aligned with the CIA.
Okay, got it now.
Some people say that you, Rona Fairhead, shouldn't be in charge of the BBC Trust because of your involvement in HSBC in the past, which was in turn involved in helping British citizens, well-off people, avoid their tax in Switzerland. What do you say to them?
Well let me say, what happened in HSBC, behaviour that was criminal, behaviour that was against the practices of the bank. We have said as a bank that we accept responsibility, and we've said that we are deeply sorry for any reputational damage and what happened. What we chose to do was to stay and fight. There has been enormous change.
And you knew nothing about this at all at the time, even though you were in charge of the committee.
No, we actually had independents coming with information. This was not disclosed. Improvements have to be made, and the reason I stayed was because the board asked me to stay, but more importantly, the regulators with whom I work did. But I have to say, my focus is now on the BBC. We need a BBC that the public want. They want it independent. They want it to be broad.
And they don't want this programme to go over either, so we have to finish. Rona Fairhead, thank you very much indeed.
Well, I mean, she's a corporate hit woman, isn't she? I mean, what journalistic background has she got to run an organisation like the BBC? Sounds to me like none at all, really.
And her vice chair is Roger Carr, who's also, he's actually one of the directors of BAE Systems, who are one of the biggest arms manufacturers in Europe.
And then the BBC just happens to show a programme about how scary the Russians are, so that the Tory government, Philip Hammond, the Defence Secretary, say, oh, we've got to spend more money on weaponry because the Russians are coming. Oh, it just happens that we're on the board of BAE Systems, and that means money in our pockets. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about.
Well, last week we spoke to Nick Much, the freelance journalist who'd written about the Bull England Club, and he told us all about connections with, even with the, I think it's Philip Dunn, he revealed last week, who's the Defence Procurement Minister in charge of Abbey Wood and Filton, also being a Bull England Club member at the same time as Boris Johnson and Dave Cameron. Not surprising, really, that they want to keep the identities of these Bull England Club people secret. And you mentioned, Martin, the Skull and Bone Society in the United States last week. The Bullingdon Club were founded in 1780, and I thought I'd see, well, was it around about the same time that this Order of Skull and Bones was founded? So let's have a listen now to Anthony Sutton, who wrote a book about the Skull and Bones called America's Secret Establishment.
The Order is truly a secret society. It was founded in the United States at Yale University in 1833. It has continued and exists down to the present day. Each year, the order takes in 15 men, senior students from Yale University. So what we have is a secret society which, over the last 150 years, has accumulated about 2,500 members, of whom perhaps 500 are alive today. Of this 500, perhaps 100 are actively in pursuit of the objectives of the order. It's not another college fraternal society. Yale University is the only university in the United States, or indeed the world, which has senior societies. These are societies where 15 are selected in the junior year and actually are initiated at the beginning of the senior year. They stay on campus only 1 year as members. They are called knights. When they graduate, they leave the university, they go out into the world, then they're known as patriarchs. So at any one time, you only have 15 knights in existence, and for the rest of their lives, they're known as patriarchs. And they work towards the ends of the order. They are pretty much guaranteed success. Certainly they're guaranteed financial success. So long as they go along with the purposes of the order, so long as they gear their careers and their lives towards certain ends, then they are guaranteed success. How did I come to this knowledge? Well, up to 6 months ago, I denied that there was a conspiracy, because frankly, I couldn't prove one. I suspected a conspiracy, but I couldn't prove there was one until 6 months ago. I received the catalogue, which is the membership list of the society, all the way back to 1833, and I received some of their internal documents, enough for me to put together the way they correspond with each other, the operations within the order, to some extent their problems, and to some extent their objectives. The order has a temple on the Yale campus. A temple, yes. It's a building, maybe this 50, 60 feet by 40 feet, maybe 40 feet high. There's no windows, two big steel doors. We know what the temple looks like because back in 1880s, a number of Yale students became a little unhappy about what was going on inside this temple. When they went by it at midnight, sometimes they heard strange noises and all kinds of rumors on the Yale campus as to what this might be. There was a break-in. I call it the Yale Gate. there was a break-in to the temple, and the students who broke in cataloged what they found, and they made a drawing, a design of the interior of the temple. The skull and crossbones are prominent in their ceremonies, initiation ceremonies.
This is a symbol of death. Now, why would they take a symbol of death?
Yes, from what I understand, when a new member is initiated, that would be in the senior year at Yale, he's placed within a coffin. And now, we only know this from the Yale Gate papers. And from the photographs we have of members inside the temple, many of these photographs are the 15 sitting around a table, and they have the skull and the crossbones sitting on the table in front of them. It is the symbol of death, and it has been called the Brotherhood of Death, and I think it probably more adequately should be called the Brotherhood of Death. So what I've had to do is look at the history, the biographies of the leading members of the order, and reconstruct their career and see if there's a common pattern in their careers. While doing that, I came across some interesting documents. Some members apparently are not too happy once they become involved with us after 10 or 20 years. One member in particular left a memorandum. He wrote it in 1932. He was buried away in his papers. I don't think anybody found it before I did. And it was a six-page memorandum on the order, naming some of the members, and said it was the most sordid thing ever happened in the history of man. So, but to come back to my point, I have to reconstruct the objectives. What are the objectives? In the words of one member, might is right. If you have the power, you use it to achieve your objectives. What is the objective? As you look at the histories of individual members, it can only be one thing: to acquire power, to keep power, to use power for their own purposes.
That's Anthony Sutton talking about the skull and bones there. Up next, it's Mohammed Makawi's Arabian Nights. Murdoch News at 7 time now. Thanks very much to Dr. Evan Jones from Bristol University. This programme's online at thisweek.org.uk, and I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.
BFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.